I begin today with a poem by Mary Oliver. Today I'm flying low, and I'm not saying a word. I'm letting all the voodoos of ambition sleep. The world goes on as it must, the bees in the garden rumbling a little, the fish leaping, the gnats getting eaten, and so forth. But I'm taking the day off, quiet as a feather. I'll hardly move, though, really, I'm traveling a terrific distance. Stillness, one of the doors into the temple. And for those of you who find the idea of taking a day off to let the voodoos of your ambition sleep, if you find that uncomfortable, like you don't have time, I have another poem. Perhaps a more challenging poem. It was for me. It's by Reverend Lynn Unger. She writes, "Breathe," said the wind. How can I breathe at a time like this when the air is full of smoke of the burning trees and burning lives? Just breathe, said the wind. Easy for you to say if the weight of injustice is not wrapped around your throat, cutting off all your air. I need you to breathe. I need you to breathe. Don't tell me to be calm when there are so many reasons to be angry, so much cause for despair. I didn't say to be calm, said the wind. I said to breathe. We're going to need a lot of air to make this hurricane together. Let us breathe together in this moment. I don't know if anyone else here has a lengthy commute. That seems to be a trend in this area. I used to listen to audiobooks when I was driving or riding the metro to help pass the time, and also to expand my mind during transit to make that time useful so it wasn't wasted. Unless I was on the phone with my moms, that's never wasted time. I have to say that, they're here. It's true though. In one of my more enlightening attempts to make the most of my commute, I decided to listen to The Miracle of Mindfulness by Thich Nhat Hanh. I thought it would be a good choice. And I remember being in the car, one hand with my breakfast, and I'm thinking about how these brake lights in front of me are gonna impact my travel time. And I'm signaling to change lanes, because of course, changing lanes in morning traffic is always efficient, right? And I'm listening to the opening of this book on mindfulness, and the narrator says, "There are two ways to wash the dishes. The first is to wash the dishes in order to have clean dishes, and the second is to wash the dishes in order to wash the dishes." I'm like, get on with it. Is this one of those recordings you shouldn't listen to while driving because it's just gonna calm you down too much? But I thought, I have to open my mind and get comfortable with this discomfort that I'm feeling. I'm always pushing myself to sit with the discomfort, so I sit with it. And he continues, "If, while washing the dishes, we think only of the cup of tea that awaits us, thus hurrying to get the dishes out of the way as if they were a nuisance, then we are not washing the dishes to wash the dishes. What's more, we are not alive during the time we are washing the dishes. We're not alive, though? I didn't realize my multitasking was actually robbing me of life. So I keep listening. In fact, we are completely incapable of realizing the miracle of life while standing at the sink. If we can't wash the dishes, the chances are we won't be able to drink our tea either. While drinking the cup of tea, we will only be thinking of other things, barely aware of the cup in our hands. Thus, we are sucked away into the future, and we are incapable of actually living 1 minute of life. So here I was trying to multitask while I'm being reminded that I should just be. I felt so confident about my ability to juggle a Diet Coke and an incoming call and merging traffic and an audiobook that I sort of scoffed at the idea of just doing one of those tasks with full intention. Or maybe we should put that warning on more things. Don't try to do too much at once, because you aren't really living in the moment. Just breathe, said the wind. I struggle with an addiction to productivity. An addiction, clinically speaking, is a compulsive behavior that interferes with your normal life, your work, your relationships, your health. I consider myself addicted to productivity because I struggle in particular with the compulsion to work harder, better, faster, and stronger all the time. To the point that I often suffer physically from fatigue and stress. The trouble with self-care advice is that it has that end goal of productivity sometimes. It makes that same mistake of washing the dishes just to get it done. If your only goal in taking a nap is so you can wake up and produce more, I'm sorry, but sleep won't help if it's your soul that's tired. The singer and performer Lizzo speaks and writes about her journey to find self-care that answers the questions: do you want to live? And if so, how? She insists that self-care is not about spa days and mimosas, but about survival and self-preservation. There's a stigma surrounding mental health, not to mention prohibitive pricing due to lack of healthcare coverage in this country. But there's a stigma particularly for the Black community. Any community who is trained to say, I got this, I'm good, I have to be good in order to prove you all wrong and say that I'm surviving. Something that Lizzo shares that she learned in therapy is to take up space, not just outer space, but inner space. When your body needs time and space to rest, let Maxine Waters chime on in with you and reclaim it. Reclaim that time that you have spent elsewhere. Reclaim that time that you have given away. Reclaim your time. Often, when you need to be recharged and revitalized, we look for rest, but Lizzo's article encourages us to think about reaching out and expanding our circle of support. That addiction to productivity trains us to isolate ourselves. It's an illusion that we must be the only ones that can do this thing. And we have to do it now, and we have to do it on our own. And when we start to expand that circle and see we're not alone, we let go of that urgency and that need to do it all ourselves. It's breaking little pieces of this cycle and living into the reality that we are not and do not have to be alone. And that also means changing our narratives, the stories that we tell ourselves, the stories that we tell about our history, and the stories that we tell our communities. Tricia Hersey was exhausted. She'd just begun her Master's in Divinity program at Emory, and it was rigorous. I can relate. But in her lecture halls, Hersey felt unseen and unheard among her mostly white peers. The 24-hour news cycle of police brutality against black people only intensified her stress, and two of her close relatives had recently passed away. And one day, a thief snatched her backpack containing all of her class notes and her research, her very first sermon, which she was scheduled to preach in 2 days. I cannot imagine what that would feel like. She says that she was so overwhelmed, she thought about just quitting school. But instead, she started napping. She napped in the campus quad and in the library and in the upholstered balcony pews in the chapel. She said it was transformative, and it actually enabled her to keep going. It was healing. Naps saved my life in a way, she says. And she talked about them the way some people talk about spiritual experiences, because for her, that's exactly what it was. Sleep is such a vulnerable place, and I believe that when you rest, it's a healing portal, she says. You have space to talk and vent, to hope and dream. You can work things out you can't work out when you're awake. This epiphany inspired her to research the idea of rest as both a healing mechanism for cultural trauma and a form of resistance against oppression. Hersey dug into the Emory Library's African American History Archives, researching the lives and legacies of enslaved Africans who labored on southern land, including her own ancestors. She studied this history through the lens of black liberation theology. It was this whole examination of labor in the South and how bodies are commodified, how capitalism and white supremacy help that, she says. Hersey talked to African Americans who lived through the Jim Crow era about how their decades-old trauma manifested physically. And after exploring scientific research on how the brain uses sleep to process trauma, she became transfixed by the idea of rest as a form of reparations and sleep deprivation as an issue of racial and social justice. Rest was not personal, it was political. In 2016, Hersey founded the Nap Ministry. Initially as kind of a performance art experiment, she hosted its first collective napping event, which 40 people attended. Since 2016, Hersey has led a dozen similar events in both Atlanta and her hometown of Chicago. Those who attend group naps are provided with yoga mats, pillows, blankets, soft music. And the most beautiful part for me about it is the sleep altar that she sets up in the room. She has candles, and she has an anthology of first-person testimonies of enslaved people. Those who were not given the permission to rest when they needed it, those who did not have that privilege. And also on the altar are pieces of cotton from southern farms. She says, "I always like to ground the room in the space of our people before us who weren't able to rest." You all should really see photos of these spaces. They're breathtaking. And this isn't just about naps. She says, "How can we resist these toxic systems that want us to be disconnected, that want us to work for 80 hours a week, that want us to feel that we're not worthy unless we're producing something? How can we resist? How can we? Breathe," said the wind. We are all swimming in the waters of white supremacy culture. It is a culture that, among other things, pushes perfectionism, a sense of urgency, values quantity over quality. It worships the written word and concrete things. It prefers either or over both and options. It lifts up individualism and believes that progress always looks like something bigger and better and more. But I believe there are antidotes to white supremacy culture. Not one, but many antidotes, because this is an ongoing process, a lifelong process of learning and unlearning what we're swimming in. As an antidote to perfectionism, we apply appreciation for the value of mistakes and lessons learned. As an antidote to urgency, we apply realistic plans. We recognize potential rather than sacrificing it. As an antidote to quantity over quality, we learn to trust the process and tell its complicated story. As an antidote to the worship of the written word and the concrete, we open our hearts and minds to the many ways to the same goal. As an antidote to either-or thinking, we offer a both-and alternative that appreciates complexity. As an antidote to individualism, we are reminded that we are not alone and need not be in competition, but in cooperation. As an antidote to the illusion that progress is always bigger and more, we draw from the wisdom and the failings of our ancestors of seven generations past. Seventh generation thinking can be overwhelming when we think about the impact of our productivity, the little impact of our productivity in seven generations ahead. But that is absolutely why we have to break out of this addiction to productivity and rest and breathe. We must make our lives sustainable so that others might live. I learned the wisdom of serving from the saucer from a beloved colleague of mine, Reverend Carol Sissel. She asked a group of us to imagine our very favorite cup and that it had a matching saucer. So go for it. Close your eyes if you need to. Imagine this beautiful cup with a wonderful saucer underneath it. And go ahead, pour in whatever your drink of choice is, cold, hot, no judgment. Pour it into that cup and keep pouring and keep pouring and keep pouring until that cup overflows into the saucer. And as the liquid, your favorite beverage, overflows into that saucer, I want you to look down into that saucer and see that is what you use to serve. You fill your cup and you refill your cup and you refill your cup and you maintain it. You must fill your cup. But don't serve from that cup. It will drain you. It's dangerous. But if you serve from that overflow, if you serve from the saucer, then that is sustainable. That will allow you to continue to serve, continue to drink from your own cup, and continue to be a presence, to be a holy presence for all of your neighbors, enemies and friends alike. So may you serve from your saucers, friends. Breathe. Breathe. May it be so, and amen.